I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At least in the first round of voting, House members, despite pleas from the White House, have voted against the $700 billion bailout deal. Let's get right to Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, you've been following this all day. House members voted at 1 p.m. East Coast time. You told us earlier it would be close. And as we said in the very first tally of votes, the bailout bill lost. Was that a shock there?
Stunned. The room was simply stunned. Usually after the last vote, members are dashing to make plans. As far as I could tell, no one left. A lot of intense discussion going on in the room, and still is. Just this second, the motion fell 205 to 228. But immediately Joe Barton, one of a Republican from Texas who voted against it, stood up and said, if I were to change my vote, when could this come up again? So it is not dead yet.
Well, we've had other times in recent history, in fact, when this has happened. I think I'm remembering the vote on the Medicare prescription bill where there was
That's exactly the parallel.
And so tell us more. What's happening now with that parallel?
Well, that vote was held open for 3 hours, and Democrats, you know, screamed that it was an abuse of power by the majority. And even in this case, you had people beginning to cry out from the floor, regular order, which is a requirement to end the vote after the 15-minute period. So people are remembering that. The leadership doesn't want to look as heavy-handed as Republicans were, but this vote couldn't be more important. I mean, even the member I just described, Emmanuel Cleaver from Missouri, who voted against this in the end, believes that the market could drop 1,000 points at the end of the day, today, and another 1,000 points.
And it's already, as we said, dropped maybe even more. I have 700 at one point a few minutes ago, so it's dropped that much. Well, now, what has happened here? Because in the bill, the money was not going to be given out in one lump sum. It would be given out in increments. There would be oversight, transparency. House Republicans got something they were looking for, which was the possibility of the government insuring these failed or failing bad assets as opposed to buying them outright. Now, we were reading reports that Secretary Paulson didn't have to use that option, but it was in the bill. So why are House Republicans so angry? They did get a little of what they wanted.
Well, they didn't change the focus of the bill, and that's really what they wanted. They didn't. The Secretary of the Treasury still has enormous powers here to determine basically who shall live and who shall die in a free market economy. That they don't like. They don't like the fact that even though he's accepted an option, he doesn't have to use it. And more to the point, they don't know who the Treasury Secretary is going to be in the next administration, or what kind of support the Congress will give at that time. Some of them see this literally as the last critical vote to defend the Reagan Revolution.
Well, there was also a portion of the bill that would require that if the Treasury didn't make money on these bad assets within 5 years, the president is then required to submit a plan to Congress to recoup some losses through new taxes or fees on the financial industry. But it sounds as if these dissenting House lawmakers weren't buying that either.
No. They're really paying close attention to what their constituents are saying and feeling. And while we can see banks toppling in Europe and, of course, a big bank failure here, they don't see it yet in their own situation. It still seems as if Main Street and Wall Street are very far apart.
Well, Gail, I just have to interrupt for 1 second to say that our wire services now, AP and CNN, are all saying that this bill is defeated. So I want to be clear. You still think that this will be held on the floor?
They're voting right now on a motion to suspend the rules. But actually, I'm not sure.
Yeah, we could be right.
It's really up in the air because if, you know, we do have people who voted no on this bill who want to bring it back, the leadership could bring it back even today if they had enough votes on it, if they felt they had the votes to pass. Right now, it looks very bad for frankly, for the leadership in both sides. It looks as if they just weren't able to rally the troops to support a position that both Democratic and Republican leaders said was essential for the health of the nation's economy.
Right. And, of course, the Senate was scheduled to take up the same vote on Wednesday, but who knows what will happen now. Gail Chadwick, who's been following this story for us for a couple weeks now, of the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, our next guest won't be at all unhappy if the bailout ultimately fails. Bruce Marks is CEO of the housing group, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. He's long been an advocate for and a supplier of affordable mortgages, but he's also been a voice warning about the problems of predatory lending. We spoke with Bruce earlier today, and I asked him first about the anger that's out there with many Americans wrongly believing that this bailout, all $700 billion of it, was to go directly into the pockets of poor people who got mortgages they couldn't afford. Now, that's not true. The money was supposed to go to investment firms. But the refrain has been, I pay my mortgage, I don't get any help. Now people who were stupid or scam artists, that's some of the language being used, are being bailed out with my taxpayer money. Again, not true. And as we're hearing, maybe no one will get any taxpayer money. But many people believe that money is going to people who have failed mortgages. I asked Bruce Marks to explain what that mistake, what that perception does to his cause.
Well, they're wrong, but they're right in one sense. They're wrong that it's going to the homeowners. But they're right in that it's going to the predatory lenders, the people who have created this crisis. The Goldman Sachs's of life, the Morgan Stanley's, the Countrywide's, every one of those predatory lenders out there, it's going to them.
Well, and let's explain. You define a predatory lender. Tell some of the examples of what the on-the-ground mortgage sellers do.
Well, you know, it is interesting, Robin. 8 years ago, I testified in Congress saying that if you allowed Fannie and Freddie to get into subprime lending and charge people higher rates and terms, it would lead to an economic disaster.
In fact, your exact words in testimony before Congress, which was considering legislation that would have regulations, you say, without these regulations, Fannie Mae will continue to expand its reach into the subprime market and might itself become a predatory lender. This poses potential risks for housing and banking. You sound very prescient. But your organization, on its website, it says no down payment, no closing costs, without perfect credit and the best interest rate, 6%, everyone gets the same terms. You know, you were doing some subprime loans.
Absolutely. We were doing subprime loans on the best terms available. No down payment, no closing costs, 30-year fixed rate, and today's rate is 6%. And you know what? We have the best performance in the industry.
But why? Meaning, what's the difference between you offering that and Fannie Mae offering
because
that?
Because we provided a prime loan to who the industry considers a subprime borrower. And what happens? They become a prime borrower because the mortgage is structured to work. It's based on what someone can afford, meaning it's not interest arm, it's not negative AM. It's a fixed rate 30-year mortgage that's locked in forever.
Help us with this.
Sure.
A prime loan to a subprime borrower.
Right.
And why was it not a subprime loan if it had no down payment and no closing costs and all of that? Why was it prime?
Because it was a fixed rate mortgage that never goes up.
It wasn't an adjustable interest rate so that maybe in 2 years their mortgage could jump from $2,000 a month to $5,000 a month.
Absolutely.
As the interest
and
rate.
That's the problem. The issue is not the no down payment. The issue is not no closing costs. The issue is whether when you're qualified for a mortgage that you can afford, and it never goes up, it stays there forever.
Why did you do that and others not? In other words, is it that you are smaller and more hands-on and work more closely with people? I mean, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is, one, we have $10 billion committed to this, so it's not a small operation. I have 40 offices around the country. But between 2003 and 2006, I did a third of the business that I did before that. And why is that? Because we could not compete with these subprime lenders.
Because you wouldn't do a subprime loan.
We wouldn't do a subprime loan. And plus, people were being qualified for $100,000, $200,000 more than we knew that they could afford. But you can't blame the homeowners for that, because when a Countrywide or a Wells or Citigroup or GMAC says to somebody, you know, trust me, yes, you can buy in a nice house where your children can go to a good school and you can walk around safely. Of course people are going to take that opportunity because they have to trust the biggest lenders in the country who gave them their word. They lied to them, but they gave them their word.
So that brings us back to where we started. You say you can't blame the homeowner, but people are. And it's kind of astonishing to me, and I'm talking about this with you because you're a housing advocate, that more people aren't blaming Wall Street or blaming these predatory lenders who literally who lied to people, who made up jobs for people, who disappeared,
right.
You know, took their shingle down and disappeared. Why aren't people blaming those people more?
Well, and that's the issue. The issue should be we got to blame the people who have created this crisis and profited from it. Remember, these individuals out there have made hundreds of millions of dollars in their own individual compensation, and we have to hold them accountable. But isn't it outrageous now that we are bailing them out with $700 billion?
But Bruce, what you know, we're being told that the Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, is down on his knees begging lawmakers to pass this bailout. That, you know, he's been short of breath over the weekend. The president has, you know, been very inelegant in his phrase, but he's quoted as saying in the Oval Office meeting, "This sucker's going down," meaning the economy. I mean, an inelegant phrase, but
right.
You know, with that kind of a warning.
But he said, Robin, he said the same thing when we bailed out Bear Stearns for $30 billion. He said the same thing when we bailed out Fannie and Freddie for $200 billion. He said the same thing when we bailed out AIG for $85 billion. Well, at some point, when you have a track record of failure, well, maybe we should question what he's saying. And how is it? And it's inconceivable. Basically, $1 trillion of taxpayer money to do absolutely nothing for the homeowner. If he was serious about doing it, he would do three things. He would do a moratorium on foreclosures, he would stop the interest rate increases, and he would force the restructuring of mortgages to what homeowners can afford. Now, he owns Fannie and Freddie. And
the government now
right,
does. It wasn't a government-backed agency prior to its takeover in
the most effective thing he can do is he could say to Fannie and Freddie, I require you to do that because they set the industry standard. And if they do that, then that means that everybody else is going to do that.
Well, let's hold up there because what is in the bailout bill? We're reading in both the New York Times and the Boston Globe that there is an aspect of the bailout bill that requires that the federal government may forestall foreclosure proceedings on home loans purchased under the plans, these securities, that these bundled securities there the government is wants to purchase from investment companies. We've heard it interpreted in other ways that the government will be allowed to restructure these loans.
But they can do it right now. They can do it right now. Sheila Bair, who's head of the FDIC, they took over IndyMac. They're doing it now. They have to do a moratorium on foreclosures. They're stopping the interest rate increases, and they're restructuring mortgages. They don't need a dollar of our money to do this. This is a bailout for Goldman Sachs and the others, and it's an outrage.
Bruce Marks, you're completely against any bailout.
I am completely against any bailout. And, you know, we have the Democratic leadership who is not just supporting this, who's pushing this. We need now, you know, the Jimmy Stewart. You know, when Mr. Smith came to Washington and Jimmy Stewart stood up and he said, and he filibustered the Senate to stop it because he was representing working people out there. We need a real life Jimmy Stewart who's going to stop this bailout for these predatory lenders, these corporations.
Bruce Marks, CEO of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. Since we spoke with him earlier today, we've watched as House members voted down the $700 billion bailout bill. The Dow plummeted on the news, has rebounded a little on word that the vote could come back or another deal could be worked out. We'll follow that for you. And be back with more from Bruce Marks in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. We've been hearing from Bruce Marks, CEO of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. We spoke to him earlier today before the stunning vote in the House against the government's proposed bailout deal. Bruce was against the bailout. He says, as Roosevelt did in the 30s, President Bush should declare a moratorium on foreclosures to keep bad mortgages from clogging the financial pipeline and boarded up unsold homes from stagnating on the housing market. Instead of the refinancing that was a part of the bailout bill, which would have started the loan process all over again, Bruce Marks said banks should restructure existing loans. He says his group has struck deals with banks that require the banks to rework mortgages when the interest rates soar and people can't pay. He says if he can do this, the government can as well. But these mortgages are now only a drop in the financial bucket because they've been bought and traded so many times that Wall Street is now billions in the hole. So we asked Bruce, how would restructuring bad mortgages help now?
I'm saying without $1 of taxpayer money, make the institutions who have created this crisis, who've profited from it, fix it. And, you know, it's a win-win for everybody, because if you do a moratorium on foreclosures, stop the interest rate increases, and restructure, meaning reduce the interest rate to what a homeowner can afford, that helps the homeowner, that helps the community, that helps the servicers who are overwhelmed, that helps the investor, that helps everybody.
Because we should just say that rather than foreclosing and a bank gets no return on a mortgage and has a house it can't sell in a stalled housing market, at least the bank or the lender is getting something back?
Absolutely. Some return is better than no return. It makes business sense for them. So we have to require that. Without a dollar of taxpayer money, we can do this through regulation, legislation, but let's use our powers of the government to make a good business decision for all the players out there. Keep the homeowners in their home. Don't look at the value of the property. Look at what someone can afford and reduce the interest rate, maybe to 5%, maybe even less, to make that affordable for the homeowners and lock that in forever, just like what NACA has done with its mortgage portfolio, who has the best performance in the country.
NACA, again, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, your group. Let's bring it back to that, because who would do this restructuring? Would it be the government, or would it be groups like yours? And is it fair for someone to say, well, wait a second, no wonder you want this, because you stand to gain if a group like yours is assigned doing this restructuring?
It can't be just a group like NACA, because it's got to be much, much bigger than NACA out there. It's got to be across the board.
Well, should it be groups like ACORN? Let me just ask you that quickly,
sure.
Because ACORN is the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, an advocacy group, but they also do voter registration. They have acknowledged some fraud, a handful of duplicate registrations. But that's given an opening for Republicans to call this idea of restructuring mortgages the ACORN bailout. And I'm just, should groups like yours, like ACORN, if they're going to be in the world of housing, get out of the world of partisan politics. ACORN registers primarily Democratic voters.
Look, it's not around. I mean, we don't do that. So, you know, it's not right. Around. I can't speak for ACORN. But what I can say is that you got to focus on the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is not what a NACA or an ACORN can do in counseling, because it is such a small percentage of all the homeowners at risk. You've got to do it for the industry. So let's look at the industry. Let's require the industry to restructure mortgages to make them affordable without a dollar of taxpayer money. You know, it's ironic because right now you have the Democratic leadership who has not just bought into this bailout of Wall Street, but is pushing it. Well, now we have to say to the liberal Democrats, buck your leadership. We have to say to the conservative Republicans, don't support corporate socialism. Because that's what it is. So we got to say to the activists out there on both the left and the right, you've got to do the right thing and stand up for working people.
Do we have to totally restructure? We're reading articles over the weekend about, you know, goodbye Wall Street. It's just never going to be the same. Do we have to totally restructure housing so that, for instance, going back to your group, NACA, your group requires no down payment? You know, without a down payment, without a financial stake in a house, aren't buyers more likely to quit or get in over their heads? Do we have to change things like that?
Absolutely not. Working people, whether you have an equity investment or not, do not walk. But when your mortgage goes up by $2,000, by $3,000, mm-hmm. to 8 to 10% and more, you can't afford that over the long term. No one can. There's no question about it. It was for short-term profits, for Wall Street, and for these lenders.
Because investors who bundle these mortgages as securities could care less if they're collected on, because they're all bundled and sent away, and it's just they're so far away from where they were initiated.
Absolutely. We used to have an entity in this country that was called community bankers. So when I went to my community banker and I said, I want a mortgage for $300,000, he or she would say, you know, that's nice, Bruce, but you only qualify for $200,000. Now what we had over the last 8 years was when they said, oh, you want a mortgage for $300,000, I'm going to give you one for $500,000.
And you can borrow against it.
And don't worry, you can refinance in 2 years, and that would be great because you could have a house that you never dreamed of. Your children can go to a school that they can be safe and that they can get a good education, and you can walk the streets safely. Who's going to turn that down? You're not talking about a loan shark making you this promise. You're talking about the major financial institutions in this country and in this world making you this promise. But who was to know that they were involved in predatory lending and really almost loan sharking practices. We knew it 8 years ago. The industry knew it, but there is so much money. It comes down to greed. And now what are we doing? We are reinforcing that greed. We're saying to them, you had a great party, and now we're going to fund that party so you can have another one down the road. It is outrageous. And you know, Robin, the American people don't buy it. The American people don't buy it because over 90% of the phone calls that they're getting from the American people say, don't bail them out.
And again, I feel I should add that the Bush administration is saying if this bailout doesn't take place, the credit market that's already frozen will freeze even further and affect people's ability to get cash, loans, student loans. But you're adamant that it is the wrong way to go.
It's the sky is falling. I mean, common sense. You know, they make this thing far more complicated than it needs to be. It's common sense.
Bruce Marks, CEO of the housing advocacy group, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, which is based here in Boston. Bruce, thank you so much for coming in.
It is great to be on. Thank you, Robin.
And again, that conversation was from earlier today. At 1 East Coast time, the House voted against the bailout bill. President Bush just issued a statement saying he's very disappointed. Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor told us Washington is stunned. The Dow down 450 points. We'll have more in the newscast coming up here and now. 7 years after 9/11, Osama bin Laden is still at large, although it's believed he's somewhere in the border region of Pakistan and Afghanistan. His trail seems to have gone cold. Well, bin Laden's location remains a mystery. Much is being learned about him and al-Qaeda thanks to the chance discovery of 1,500 audio cassettes found in his former compound in Kandahar, Afghanistan in 2001. Here's an excerpt from one tape. It was recorded in 1996. Bin Laden's addressing William Perry, who was President Clinton's Secretary of Defense.
غدا ستعلم يا ويليام أي فتى يلقى أخاك الذي قد غره.
Bin Laden talks about the smoke of war, blades of lances red, and the young men who could confront Americans. Well, the tapes were deemed worthless by locals who found them. They eventually found their way, though, to Flag Miller, a religious studies professor at UC Davis who specializes in political discourse in the Arab world. He joins us. And, Professor, there are thousands of hours of tapes. What are you doing with them?
So I'm just getting going. I focused on a good 40, 50 of the tapes. The ones I've spent more time with are those by bin Laden himself.
And how many are they?
I've found 20 to date, and of that material, there are 12 cassettes that have all new material, none of which has been published yet.
The fact that there are only 20 from bin Laden maybe is the reason why U.S. intelligence officers didn't wade through all of these tapes to try to find, you know, the nugget. But we understand that CNN had these tapes at one point. Just tell us, how did they make their way to you?
CNN gathered a number of audio and video tapes from around Kandahar, from the training camps. Of course, CNN easily used the video, and those were the first scenes the world audiences got of al-Qaeda's training camps in 2001. But they didn't know what to do with the audio. 98% of this stuff is in Arabic. It's hard to use that stuff on CNN. The FBI was offered the chance to look at the tapes, and they declined stewardship. And so they moved on to an academic community. In the United States, there was a William Afghan Media Project at Williams College. CNN decided that would be a good place to deposit the collection.
And they called in you. Now, here you are. You speak Arabic. What was your thought when you first heard that there's this trove of tapes, first of all, from Afghanistan, and that Osama bin Laden is on some of the tapes?
Well, it was a very surreal kind of experience. I'd been working on audio cassettes in Yemen and Islam, and so it wasn't surprising that a prominent Muslim thinker or militant in this case would have audio cassettes. It was only when I really began sifting through this material I started to realize that a whole range of new material that I think has the potential to really open our eyes on just the kind of breadth of intellectual discourses going on at the time.
Well, tell us about it, because we know the tapes are from the 1960s to 2000. So give us an example of what you found illuminating.
I think what I found most surprising was a range of, I would say, 5 or 6% of the collection is very creative, kind of off-record recordings. anthems about martyrs or just some of them about love.
Why were you surprised in that we understand that, you know, poetry is so very important in the region, and a lot of the push to be a warrior, we understand, comes through speaking ancient poetry?
I was surprised because at the time we were getting a lot of news stories from Afghanistan about the way the Taliban cracked down on public song. And what we find is that this collection contains this kind of material, and it would have been the kind of thing people listened to in private, including bin Laden.
But we understand that you also see that you very clearly hear through these tapes how he used poetry to keep his flock close and away from the, you know, the outside secular world and keep them on message.
Yeah, his poetry is very focused. He is very much a militant. His poetry is directed specifically toward emphasizing the glories of jihad, the glories of armed combat, and the glories of martyrdom.
How does his voice and what you hear in his voice change from the early recordings of the 80s when he's recruiting people to go on jihad in Afghanistan to, you know, close to 2000 when he's actually leading, you know, his own movement, the Al-Qaeda movement?
Well, one of the things in the early recordings that comes across is the personal aspect of jihad for him. It's not yet a kind of metaphysical confrontation with the Judeo-Christian world, but what's more primary for him is this battlefront experience, a very physical and sometimes grim witnessing of the ways in which the human spirit can triumph over pain, can triumph over, you know, the last moments of death as one's limbs are shattered and you know, intestines filled with shrapnel. I mean, it gets quite gory, that there is a place for peace, and there's a way to situate one's own fleeting life in what he views to be the larger, glorious mission of jihad.
I've heard you also say that closer to 2000, you start hearing the anti-Western language that really isn't there in the beginning, that that evolves.
Well, in the late 80s, what's interesting is that, well, much of his recruiting effort is focused in Afghanistan. He also talks about the broader Islamic world as under the threat of the United States, especially in supporting Israel and the strength of the Jews in that conflict.
You heard that as early as the 80s?
Yes, mm-hmm. Before the first Gulf War. He already has a kind of developed sense of the threat of the West, and particularly the United States, in economic terms. Of course, he was a, you know, multinational financier and a CEO, so he well understood the power of the dollar. But that message in later years becomes developed. He takes a more central role as a leader in his speeches from the mid-90s onward. He very much is speaking in the first person as a model, as a hero himself, who can lead the Islamic world in a confrontation that begins first and foremost with the West.
We understand now that the tapes are being cleaned up, they're being digitized at Yale University, and that public access is planned. There's also been critics who've said to give any airing of bin Laden's poetry or bin Laden speaking poetry or bin Laden speaking at a wedding is obscene, that it just elevates him, it just adds to the legend. What do you think about whether or not people should be able to hear all or 12 or 20 of the tapes?
I think what these tapes offer us the opportunity to do is to situate bin Laden's voice among many other voices at the time. And the question becomes, is bin Laden truly kind of the unique visionary that he claims himself to be? To what extent do others contest him, and how is he trying to pitch his message to these much broader and moderate discourses in Islam? One of the problems with the way bin Laden's statements are often approached in a lot of scholarship and journalism is that his statements are taken as self-evident, but the breadth of all of this material in the collection suggests that bin Laden's statements are a part of a very complex culture of performance. And to understand how his statements are both far transcend his actual ability to carry them out and also fall short of popular Muslim expectations of what's credible and what's not, one has to understand his statements in relation to this very complex world of cultural positioning and ethical debate.
That's Flagg Miller of the University of California, Davis. For more of his translations, you can go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Question. Why have 28 leatherbacks been found dead along the southeastern coast of Massachusetts recently, maybe the most ever? Leatherbacks are gloriously large aquatic turtles. They can weigh up to 2,000 pounds and grow as big as a Volkswagen. They're listed as endangered species, and it would seem that they are even more endangered after this past summer. Why? Connie Marigo is a rescue biologist at the New England Aquarium. She's been working with sea turtles for 15 years. And Connie, we understand along with the uptick in deaths, there's been an uptick in the number of leatherbacks migrating from further south back up to Massachusetts. Why is that?
Well, we're not entirely sure this year. Leatherbacks tend to follow their food source, and for them that's jellyfish. So we do have a high presence of jellyfish in the area this year, and that's probably the reason, but I would say we'd probably need a little more research to see if there are other issues going on as well.
We know that when these glorious creatures wash up or are found, they're often too decomposed to work with, but what do you suspect is, you know, at least some of the cause of their death?
You know, there has been a high number of boat strikes this year, which is a little bit unusual for us, but that's also because there's a lot more animals in the area.
Well, tell us about this, because we understand that at least some of them are getting hit by boats or getting caught in fishing lines or lobster trap lines, you know, human issues. So what do you warn boaters about these turtles?
I think the idea is to try to get people to understand that these animals are in the area. And I think that's one of our biggest problems, is that the general public, they don't seem to realize that these majestic animals are sharing the waters. And they're a large animal, but they're black, and they don't break the surface very much when they come up to breathe. So if you're boating around and you haven't got your eyes directly on the water in front of you, you just maybe turn to even chat with a friend, it can be that quick. They can just come up to take a breath. And again, they don't break the surface much. They sit just at the surface. If there's even the slightest chop or the sun in your eyes, you might not see them.
So be more careful and look for them. We know you also recommend wearing infrared sunglasses so you're more likely to see them. And what do you do when you see them?
Well, avoiding them is the best thing. They're an endangered species. They're a protected species. But, you know, there's no problem with just enjoying them, being able to watch them. Leatherback sea turtles are almost like a dinosaur that still exists. They're large black animals. Their heads are enormous. They're probably three times the size of a human head. We're guessing they live over 80 years, probably more than that. They're the equivalent of a slightly deflated Volkswagen Bug with 3.5 foot to 4 foot flippers on each side.
Oh, my gosh.
They're just prehistoric looking. And so, you know, I mean, I would say it's really going to be the talk of the town if you see one. If you're out fishing or sailing and you happen to see one, you know, it's something you'd be talking about for years.
So really look for them for many reasons, to save them, but also for the experience.
Exactly. They're beautiful, beautiful animals.
Is there any chance that there's a biological cause, a pollution or a parasite?
There's a chance. We haven't seen any evidence of that this summer. But, you know, they are sea turtles, so they are susceptible to disease and viruses, and, you know, they're air breathers, so should they get caught on anything, you know, that can be recreational line that's left in the water or commercial lines or netting, anything like that, they have to be able to surface to breathe. So there's a number of things that they're exposed to, but also just natural, you know, old age probably as well. And, you know, they're animals, so they're subject to all of that.
I want to go very quietly look for one. You know, they sound, I mean, it just is magnificent. What function do they perform?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I mean, I think every animal has its role in the ecosystem. And, you know, what we want to make sure is that we don't lose them. I guess that's primary. But what role they actually play is something we probably don't entirely know. We know without them, it would affect the food chain. It would affect the environment. You know, there'd be a hole in the cycle there. So there'd be a lot of shifting in species above or below. But their actual purpose, that's a great question. I don't know that we have the exact answer to that in science.
Maybe it's just to enjoy them and watch out for them.
Well, you know, they've lasted over 50 million years, so there's got to be a reason for them. It's really, they're truly amazing creatures.
Connie Marigo, a rescue biologist for the New England Aquarium, talking about the endangered leatherback turtles here in the New England area. Connie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, to see pictures of the big old leatherbacks, go to our website, here-now.org. Quick note about some of the stories in the works at Here and Now. As we said, actor Greg Kinnear is going to be here tomorrow to talk about his latest film, Flash of Genius. Singer-songwriter Patty Larkin will stop by our studios in the coming days, and we're also going to look back at the first and only interracial comedy team, Tim and Tom, Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. That's in the days ahead. But back in a minute with physicist Brian Green, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to physicist Brian Green. Science is the most exciting adventure story in human history, and now he's written a children's book to back his theory. Green is professor of physics at Columbia and author of several books for adults, including The Elegant Universe. His latest for kids is Icarus at the Edge of Time, an illustrated retelling of the ancient Greek myth of the boy who flies too close to the sun. The book also introduces young readers to black holes. Ah, black holes. Remember when the Hadron Particle Collider in Switzerland began its work recently? It's now offline because of technical problems and is expected to go back into operation early next year. Scientists hoping to use the collider to create particles that they believe existed around the time of the Big Bang, using protons and crashing them together. Well, some people worried that the collisions could create giant black holes. So, Brian, first of all, since you write about black holes in your new book, what are these particles and why are scientists trying to recreate them?
Well, the goal of particle physics is to figure out what things are made of, the fundamental constituents of matter and the fundamental constituents of the universe that may have existed in an ancient time but have long since disintegrated. So by smashing these protons together at incredibly high speeds, the idea is to use their energy to create particles that we haven't seen in the laboratory in any natural setting, and in that way gain a deeper understanding of how the universe is put together.
Well, as we said, some people are afraid that these collisions will create black holes that could swallow up the whole world. Now, you write that if the experiment does create black holes, they'd be very tiny and short-lived, and we could study them. So tell us first, what is a black hole?
Well, a black hole we usually think of as a region of space where an incredible amount of matter has been crushed to a very small size, creating a powerful gravitational field. So if you go too near a black hole, you can't pull away. You get sucked in.
Was it you who, in your writing, gave an example of a black hole being like if you squeezed an orange all the way down?
Exactly. I was given that as an example because black holes don't have to be big. They can also be small. And the example I gave in that Times op-ed was take an orange, and if you squeeze it sufficiently small, about a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a meter across, it would be a black hole, a small one, with the mass of an orange.
You've brought much of this down to a much more edible chunk. In your new book for children, it's called Icarus at the Edge of Time. It's a retelling of the story of Icarus, and of course, in ancient Greek mythology, remember, he fled the island of Crete with his father Daedalus, who'd made wings for them and warned his son not to fly too close to the sun, but he was so exhilarated that he did fly too high, and then Paul Winter wrote a song about it. No, I'm sorry. Beautiful song about Icarus, but the sun singed his wings, and he fell to death, his death in the ocean. In your telling, you set the father and son in outer space, and where are they going?
Well, they are on a journey to a faraway planet where we have learned that there is life, so they are en route to rendezvous with the first life discovered beyond Earth's shores.
But it's a journey that takes so long that generations of this one family, the great-grandfather and the grandfather and the father and the son, they've been reproducing on this spaceship in order to get to this other planet.
That's right. It takes five generations to get there in this story.
But they come across a black hole in their travels. And Icarus, who's 14, wants to go see it. He gets on his little space jet and he goes. He gets lost in time.
Yes. The point of the story is basically through the power of narrative, through the power of storytelling, not lecturing, not pedagogy, to communicate some real science. I mean, Einstein's discovery with his general theory of relativity that there's this possibility of black holes that can warp space and time, these are complex ideas. And usually a 7 or 8 or 9 year old won't encounter these ideas. But in a story setting, if the ideas of relativity can inform the narrative, then a kid can immerse themselves in this wonderful science without having to learn the details. And that's what this book is really about.
We had it reviewed by the eminent reviewer, Gwynna, who writes, "I think your book was stupendous, but it was sad. Because what happens is that Icarus does go to the black hole. He thinks everything's fine, but what he doesn't realize is that the black hole has so slowed time that when he finally comes back, the spaceship and his father are long, long gone, thousands of years gone."
Well, it is a cautionary tale. It's not of the same sort as the original Icarus myth, where death is what the penalty is. But here, the idea is Icarus is ripped from his familiar reality by the black hole and lands in a new one, one that he'll have to acclimate to. And to me, that's more what science is about. The original Icarus myth always struck me as a little odd. We are taught as scientists, challenge authority, challenge the accepted order, find something new. And yet when Icarus in the original myth does that, goes exploring, he has to pay with his life.
Right.
So what really happens in science, when you find something new, we as a culture have to acclimate to that new reality. The atomic age, we had to acclimate to that. The biological age, we have to acclimate to the possibility of forming life maybe in the laboratory at some point. And that's what science is about, and that's what happens here. Icarus, through his headstrong exploration, comes into contact with his black hole, doesn't die, but does have to deal with a new reality that that exploration leads him to.
Well, and as we said, he comes back and everyone says, "Oh, you're the boy who was lost thousands of years ago. He was trapped in this time warp. He didn't think that much time had passed." So here's my question to you. And Gwynne had it too. So how come when he comes back from the black hole, why doesn't he suddenly age?
Because the wonders of relativity are all about the relative elapsed time. So the idea is his watch is running very slow when he's near the black hole. Therefore, the watches of everybody far away are running, relatively speaking, very fast. So an hour for him on his watch is many, many, many years, many centuries for everybody else who's far away from the black hole. When he returns, his watch then starts to run at the rate of everybody else's. But during his time away, it was running slow, so he is younger.
Huh.
And I should say, this is real science. This is not something that's conjectured. Experiments, not with a boy near a black hole, but others have shown that this is actually how time works.
That gets us to another thing you believe strongly, which is how science is taught. This was fun, a fun read, you know, and interesting. What's wrong with the way we're teaching science today?
I think there are a lot of things wrong, but the one in particular that I've been focusing on lately is I think we too quickly jump into the details with kids. Too quickly we want them to solve equations, balance reaction, know parts of a cell, and look, that is important stuff. I am not one who goes away from the hard science that needs to be understood by kids as they go forward in their education. But at the same time, we need to have a commensurate focus on the wonderful ideas, the exciting vistas that science has opened up. Black holes and the Big Bang and nanoscience and quantum physics, there are wonderful ideas in there. And if we can get those ideas across to kids in a way that they can take it in, where it's fun and exciting and wondrous, they'll be motivated to then learn the details. And I think that's the mistake we make, not giving them that exciting side of science.
Well, and you have tried to get at that from another angle, too. You organized the World Science Festival in New York City this past summer, and the New York Times reported that you may have created a new cultural institution. What did you want to do there?
It was the exact same goal. It was trying to bring not only kids but the general public of all ages into science in a way where they'd find it compelling and exciting and not off-putting and intimidating. So we had 45 live events where we had great scientists with great moderators, well-produced programs that people could go to and learn about cosmology and neuroscience, the sustainability and alternative energies, all great science in a way that was really exciting. And the fact that 120,000 people came to this festival, I think, is testament to the fact that there's a hunger out there for science to be communicated in a way that people really can understand.
Like telling the story of a little boy who flies too close to a black hole.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's Brian Greene, professor of physics at Columbia, author of several books, including The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos. His newest work, Icarus at the Edge of Time, a retelling of that ancient Greek myth. So, Brian, thanks so much for coming to talk to us about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.